Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes. And welcome to another episode of the Fergan podcast. This episode, I have another fine guest with me. Her name is Emma Lucy Shaw, and she is a British, well, I guess at the moment, expat who's currently living in Peru, but will hopefully be finding her way home very soon. I think I became aware of Emma before she actually started her Telegram channel. I saw a good friend of mine, Hammerson, shared a video of her performing a poem that she had written, which I thought was wonderfully written and very heartfelt. And she, from that point on, she just seems to have kind of captured a lot of people's imagination. And I think part of the reason for that is because of her honesty. I think a lot of people identify with the journey that she's been on, and I'll let her talk a bit about that. But coming from, like myself, coming from quite a liberal background, you know, a kind of liberal scene, and finding her way to this seemingly verboten worldview of this kind of folkish worldview that she and I both share. Could you welcome Emma? It's good to be speaking to you. And could you just tell the listeners a little bit about who you are, what you do, and maybe a little bit about your background?
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm an artist. I was born and raised in Coventry. After the death of my parents, I left there quite young and I went on this very nomadic path of trying to find myself. It sounds a bit cheesy, but that's kind of what it was. And it took me to many places, to quite far away and exotic lands. And in that whole process, it kind of brought me home spiritually inside. And now I'm here now sharing my art and speaking out about things.
Great. Yeah. It's almost as though in moving geographically so far away from home, you kind of spiritually came home. Would that be an accurate way of putting it?
Yeah, I feel like I had to go really far to kind of realize how sacred my homeland is. It's not that I didn't appreciate it, but the system had always felt so heavy on me. And I just wanted to get away from the system from as young as I can remember. And I didn't grow up in the countryside. If I grew up in the countryside, it might have been different, but I grew up in the middle of Coventry. And it was quite rough. And I just feel I had to go far away. And in that process mostly around indigenous people from the Americas, I started to realize what was missing inside.
Yeah, I can definitely sympathize with that draw to these kind of wild, far-flung lands. I mean, my wife and I have talked over the years about relocating to, you know, various places around the world, usually places that have an Anglo culture like New Zealand or Canada or places like that. But the idea of moving somewhere like South America has come up once or twice. And it's fascinating to me to hear about your experiences over there because I'm English and have recently moved to Wales. And even that tiny, tiny little leap does, you know, there is this kind of feeling of being placed into a new and slightly unfamiliar place. But I can only imagine how magnified that would be moving somewhere like South America. And I can imagine how, you know, although you would find some wonderful things over there, you'd also realize what it is about home that is so great and what you miss. And I guess that's what happened with you. You realized just how connected you were with your ethnicity, with your homeland.
Yeah, because there's parts of South America that are more European, like Argentina and Chile, but I came to probably one of the most indigenous parts of the Americas.
Yeah.
So it's very different. I also appreciate and respect the Andean people there. It's not like what was happening in Mexico with the Aztecs, where they were doing some pretty brutal things. When the Spanish and the church arrived here, they were a sun people. They worshipped their solar deity. They were not really, they didn't really practice mass sacrifice. Every so often, a priestess of the sun would walk up a mountain to sacrifice herself for the tribe in times of drought. But they were pretty noble people. And it's been amazing to be here. There's some megalithic ruins here that I believe kind of changed the whole history of humanity, because they have intense erosion on them, and they're still a peasant society here, so they still plow their fields with the bull. And I've been granted kind of a timeout from the system and able to have kind of a very easy, affordable life, and really going into my creativity. Because one of the reasons I left the West is because it wasn't allowing me the time to be an artist, because I had to work and drain all my energy away, the best hours of the day, making other people rich, when I had this fire inside with my creativity. So that was the main reason to leave. And I feel I've been hosted very well. I've been very respectful. Like, I can speak a bit of Quechua, which really touches them, because that's actually their native language, not Spanish. And I've had a really nice time here. And at the same time, as the years passed, I just got an overwhelming sickness for home. I remembered the oak trees and mossy stones and everything I loved about the countryside, everything that felt very spiritual to me back home. And when I became a mother here, it was even more, it made me feel very much like this isn't my homeland, as much as I love it here in many ways. When I became a mother, it became a bit challenging. I became quite aware I was a gringa, and yeah.
Yeah, I can sympathize with that. But when you have children, your thoughts immediately turn to their future, who their potential mates, their, you know, husbands or wives are going to be, what ethnic gene pool they're going to become part of. And if you're somewhere like Peru or somewhere that doesn't quite feel like home, then the responsibility that you have to kind of preserve your ethnic bloodline becomes all the more stark and apparent at that point. So yeah, I can very much sympathize with that. And I think any one of our mindset who has children, that feeling becomes very tangible very quickly. So yeah, I think one of the reasons that I've enjoyed your thoughts and your poems and your art and the things that you put across on your channel so much is because I can very much identify with the place you come from, the scene you come from. You know, I come from quite a liberal music, like alternative music scene background. I know that you come from a kind of, you know, psychedelic, I guess. I know that you also have a involvement with music, with art. And I believe you worked in Norway at a kind of Viking reenactment. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I know how, I know what those kind of scenes can be like, what the people in those areas. And obviously I'm still friends with a lot of the people from those backgrounds, you know, particularly the ones who are open-minded enough to realize that, I may hold different views on certain things to them, but I'm a good person and I mean well. And I would assume that you've managed to maintain friendships with a lot of the people from those scenes. But yeah, firstly, is that correct to say that you kind of, you come from those scenes. What are the scenes that you moved in most?
I guess, yeah, like 2007, 2008, I had quite an ethnic awakening because I was living in Leicester when I was studying archaeology and the English became a minority. But I subsequently kind of buried that because it actually made me very depressed. And my parents had died not long ago. I just had a lot on my plate. So I just kind of buried that for a while. I didn't want to think about it. Just wanted to get on with things. But I still had this deep ancestral calling. So I ended up in Norway at Gudfangen at the very kind of beginnings. Now it's this kind of fancy Viking village. But back then it was very rustic. You had Kai, the singer from Heilung, who had a tent there, who was tattooing everyone. And it was this very shamanic experience. You would go into the tent, there'd be someone drumming, and he would be tattooing ancestral symbols on someone. There was Aina from Wadruna. He would be walking around there with his family, and then they would perform. And it was an incredible experience. It awoke something in me. And I made very good friends there. And I heard there, actually, people talking about ayahuasca and going to the Amazon and experiencing altered states of consciousness, which interested me very much because watching my mom die of lung cancer in the conventional treatment of chemotherapy and seeing how that actually just destroyed her final time, when maybe we could have just been preparing her for death instead of trying to fight it. So I was very much interested in experiencing hallucinogenic plants because I heard they help you find peace with death. So then from this kind of Viking scene, I went to South America. I never really went to hippie festivals or anything like a lot of people go to festivals, take acid, and maybe they get into ayahuasca. That wasn't really my path to it. It was a genuine interest in natural medicine that led me to the Amazon. And this was 10 years ago, before ayahuasca was promoted by Hollywood, before it became really mainstream. So it was quite an underground backpacking route through the jungle. And I met very interesting people there. And I had a very life-changing experience. For me, it was very visionary. I just completely out of body experiences where I went on journeys where I was able basically to find peace with my parents' death and my creativity was restored. So I left that experience knowing I was an artist and that's what I should be doing with my life. And then after that, I kind of got caught up in the psychedelic movement. And I guess I was just kind of, I did some conventions like the Breaking Convention in London, which is about psychedelic science. And then I did one in Hollywood, and that was kind of a bit freaky. And that's where I realized this is a bit strange, because it was kind of a freak show. I could see it was a plastic kind of scene, and I feel like I went to Hollywood and I had this test there. Do I want to go down this path of being like this psychedelic artist in this scene, or do I want to just be a genuine artist following my heart, but not getting caught up in stuff that doesn't feel right in my soul? So after that, I started to kind of distance myself from the psychedelic movement. I went back to Peru, and I honestly think I was trying to chase my original experience, because that was so life-changing. Then going back to the system in England was really difficult, and I felt like I just couldn't do it because I'd been opened up so much that going back to the system, I just felt like I had to go. If I wanted to be an artist, I needed to leave for a while and figure that out. Mm. So I went back to Peru, maybe chasing that experience again, and then I never really found it again. I went really deep to the jungle. I stayed with the Shipibo tribe in a village, and that experience, I feel, was quite sad. They'd been settled for about 30 or 50 years. They'd been Christianized, And it just felt like the very early stages of what our ancestors went through. Like they'd just been taken out of the forest. And you can say what you want about them. Yeah, they were warrior tribes that like spent a lot of time fighting each other, but the jungle is really violent and they were part of that. And they were kind of taken out of their organic way of life and settled and Christianized and started to leave a lot of questions in me. And then I came to Cusco just mostly because of the archaeology. I've always wanted to visit this part of the world. And then I just kind of stayed. There were quite a few expats out here my age that were artists, and you could find a nice house for like £200 a month to rent. And it was just quite nice, the people I found here, the community I found, and I enjoyed it for a few years until it just became very apparent to me that this is not my homeland. I'm never going to be Peruvian.
Hmm. It sounds like everything that's kind of happened along your journey happened in a particular way for a particular reason. You know, you said that you feel like you almost tried to rediscover that kind of psychedelic period of your life by returning to Peru, but were never really able to. But instead, you discovered other things and perhaps discovered that sense of identity and of ethnic identity and of homeland. So yeah, it's funny how in life kind of we go through these phases of these really enjoyable periods of life, which feel like the best times of our life. And sometimes I think people try to hang on to those for too long. And I think that's why we end up in the West with so many people who are our age. I mean, I think you and I are sort of roughly the same age. I'm not sure exactly how old you are, but I have friends who are my age, late 30s, who are still acting, they're still living as though they're university students. You know, they're trying to minimize the amount of responsibility that they have in life, trying to recreate that kind of weekend party atmosphere and stuff like that. And it's quite sad to see that, really, I think. And I think one of the most difficult things is to accept that you can't recreate your past. You know, I think that's something that a lot of people struggle with. But from listening to your story, it seems like even though perhaps that's what you tried to do initially, you very quickly realized that that wasn't going to be possible. And instead, you discovered this whole kind of whole new world and this whole new way of expressing yourself. And I can very much kind of, again, sympathize with your interest in psychedelics and, you know, Peruvian antiquity. You know, I probably my introduction to the kind of dissident mindset, ironically, I think a lot of people will find this quite strange, was reading the book Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock. And that book is primarily about the pyramids at Giza in Egypt and their antiquity, and he puts forth the suggestion that they're actually much, much older than conventional history says they are. He also in other books touches upon the South American, you know, Aztec and other high civilizations, saying that they're much older than we believe they are, and the function of those temples is not what we think they are. And you've got the Baalbek stone, isn't it? And, you know, these huge stones, which we don't have the capability of lifting now with our modern technology. So that side of things always hugely fascinated me. And what that made me realize was that actually, you know, we're raised to believe that we are the pinnacle of human civilization, that humans have never been as intelligent or creative or good as we are now. But when you read those books by people like Graham Hancock and Robert Bovall and others like that, you actually are presented with this idea that actually, if you go back into distant antiquity, our ancestors were likely wiser, more spiritual, more in tune with the earth than we are today. Yeah. And I'm guessing that that's something that's an idea that appealed to you. And Graham Hancock also wrote a book called Supernatural, which that was the first time I'd ever heard of ayahuasca. And I read that book when it first came out, which must have been, I don't know,
2012 or something.
I think it was before then, because I was still living with my parents, and I've not lived with my parents for at least 12 or 13 years. So I think it was more like 15 years ago, probably, that book came out. But yeah, you're right. Since then, I think that book probably played a large role in it. Since then, ayahuasca has become this huge kind of tourist thing. But yeah, I mean, just as a kind of side thing, had you read those books by Graham Hancock? Is that part of the reason that you were interested in psychedelics and South American ancient culture?
Yeah, my parents had Fingerprints of the Gods when I was a kid, and they were really into this because my granny, my mother's mom, used to say she was abducted by aliens. Like, she went mad. So I'm not saying that was a true story, but I was basically raised around this idea. And my parents, yeah, they loved Graham Hancock back in the 90s. And if he was on the TV, which occasionally he was, and other people like that, we would, as a family, we would watch these things. I remember he was on BBC Horizon when I was young, yeah, and they really ridiculed him. I remember that. And yeah, this is like one of the main reasons I always wanted to come to Peru, because it's just absolutely filled with megalithic remains and mysteries and legends of ancient white people, which is perfectly accepted by the locals here. They will tell me that, oh yeah, there used to be people with red hair here.
It's interesting you mentioned that. I was going to mention that as well, because Graham Hancock himself is very ultra liberal, especially kind of in a ethnic sense. And I believe he's actually married to someone
Indian,
yeah,
Sri Lanka woman. Yeah.
And I'm not going to kind of cast aspersions on him for that or anything, but it always amazed me, even years ago when my kind of ethnic worldview hadn't fully formed. It amazed me how he recognized that there was this recognition among the South Americans of these white teachers of high civilization, Quetzalcoatl and stuff like that. But yet he completely denounced the idea of preserving ethnic identity, especially for Europe. Well, he's probably very much in favor of preserving ethnic identity for non-Europeans, but when it comes to Europeans, he would probably heavily oppose any moves that were designed to preserve the ethnic identity of European people. So even back then, I sensed that hypocrisy in him. And anyone who's listening to this, who's thinking about going and reading his books, you know, just bear in mind that he is not folkish in any way, even though the conclusions that he draws in his book do point to the importance of ethnic preservation.
Yeah, I agree. I think the levels of brainwashing are just so deep, it's just really hard for people to grasp that we are ethnic peoples that have a right to a homeland and to defend our homelands from demographic replacement. It's just really hard for people, a lot of people, to comprehend because of the brainwashing. And then he's married to a non-European, so it's going to be really hard for him to ever comprehend that, because his children are mixed race. And that's always happened in history. A minority of people have traveled around.
Yeah.
You know, there's British people here married to Peruvians. Their kids will blend into Peru. I don't have a judgment about that. I just know that that's not my path. I want to offer my kids their homeland and their people and their heritage.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And as you say, these things, people of different ethnic groups or different races coming together, having children, it happens. It's happened throughout history. It's the kind of the culture that we have now that actually promotes that and says that anyone who doesn't want to take that path is wrong somehow for consciously choosing not to take that path. That's the problem. It's not the few kind of anomalous cases here and there of people doing it that's the problem. So, I mean, the other thing that I've really enjoyed about the way that you present yourself and your ideas is that you don't come from a place of hatred whatsoever. You know, I feel like you come from a very similar mindset to mine, which was, as I always say, I've always been in favor of all of the world's different ethnic groups and cultures being preserved. I've always been a big fan of global multiculturalism, you know, to put it in sort of their language. My big crime was applying that same logic to my own ethnic group. And it doesn't mean that I hate anyone of any other backgrounds. And I'm sure you have now have lots of Peruvian friends. You think nothing bad of them whatsoever and admire them for who they are. But nevertheless, in order to preserve who we are, to preserve the various European ethnic groups, there does have to be a certain mindset of recognizing that there is a difference. And the Peruvians that you speak to, it sounds like they instinctively know that there is a difference and that they have their own ethnic identity and you have yours, and that there's nothing wrong with that. But as soon as you come back to Europe or go to one of the colonies, America, Australia, whatever, suddenly you're told that, no, you know, you're wrong for thinking that way, when to the entire world outside of, you know, the white lands, it's perfectly natural and normal. So, you know, have you, I mean, how have you kind of found it coming from that liberal scene that you came from, and trying to convince people that you're not coming from a place of hatred in this worldview that you've kind of discovered over the years and nurtured this recognition of, as you put it, the ethnos? Have you found it difficult to kind of make people realize that you're not coming from a place of hatred?
It hasn't been difficult talking to non-white Peruvians about it. It's just like common sense to them. They know I'm English. When people ask where you're from and I say Inglaterra, they're always like, wow, a great people, a great history. And they like admire that. But when I guess it was 2020, there was the lockdown. And then there was the psychological operation of George Floyd that I just didn't get involved with. I didn't post a black square. And I made it very clear, I'm not going along with this. This is a psychological operation. Like, this is ridiculous. And then I got so heavily attacked that it was pretty intense at first. I'd never been called a racist in my life. I'd never been called a white supremacist and all this stuff. And at first, I don't know, it's like the worst thing you can call someone in the West, these names, they can destroy your life. And at first I was kind of defending myself, but then I got to a point of confidence that actually, no, there's nothing hateful about what I'm saying, because I think this system doesn't care about black people either. It doesn't care about anyone. And it likes to put us all together in these multicultural societies that destroy kind of high trust, and then they just psyop us all to hate each other. I grew up in a very multicultural part of England in Coventry, so I had a lot of black mates when I grew up. I was a bit of a chaff, used to hang around the estates, and I remember when grime music happened and the promotion of gangster rap, because I remember some of the black communities before the push of like violent pop culture. And they've also been psyoped and made to be violent, and they're displaced from their motherland, far away, mostly in concrete things. And you can go on at them for the differences, but I don't like to do that. I want all peoples to be free in this world and fight this globalization, this parasite that just wants to make us all a soup. It's not hateful that I defend my people, because I also wish that for all other peoples to do that. That's the only way we're going to resist, is that all peoples on earth have a sense of ethnos in the face of this parasite that just wants to enslave us all.
Yeah, the immigrants are not our enemy. And I've never once treated an immigrant with any lesser respect simply because they were an immigrant. And, you know, I dare say that's the same for you. I mean, you know, many of us come from the same place. And I think this is, again, I think this is why, you know, so many people have been attracted to your ideas, the way you've presented yourself, is because there is this, unfortunately, there is this faction of the kind of the folkish worldview, this white nationalist faction. And unfortunately, there are many among them who do base their worldview on hatred. They do go out of their way to use racial slurs and things like that. And I'm not going to sit here and try and censor people and tell people what words they can and can't use or anything like that. But it's just never appealed to me, that kind of approach. I've always been much more of the approach of, having respect for all ethnic groups of the world and demanding the same respect in return from them. So that means that if I go to their country, I recognize that that is their land, it belongs to them, and I am a guest. And I also feel that the same should be done in return when non-Europeans come to European countries, or even if an Italian comes to England, or a German goes to, Slovenia or something like that, that there should always be this respect that, you know, that that is a country that does not belong to you. You are there as a guest. Perhaps if you love that country enough and you want to stay there, then you can start to have a stake in that land, and you can start to build bonds with the locals there, and perhaps in time your descendants will become part of their nation. But it doesn't happen within a lifetime. It certainly doesn't happen the moment you step out of the airport.
No.
Anyway, I think we're pretty much on the same page with that one. So yeah, I just wanted to kind of express my appreciation for the way that you put yourself across, because I think it's a really important approach to the struggle that we are part of. It's a really important approach to highlight the fact that we do have respect for other ethnic groups of the world. We just ask for the same respect in return.
Yeah. And if you're going to be hateful, it's why I had to close my chat down in the end, because it's just like, this will get me in trouble. And it's not like, I don't talk like this. No. And how are we ever going to get through to most of the rest of our people if we're literally acting like a stereotypical hateful person that is really easy to demonize? It doesn't help anything.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, you can have whatever opinions that you have. I'm not going to like tell you what to think. But I personally actually respect the diversity of this planet, that it has many different racial and ethnic groups. And I would like everyone to be able to thrive, even if that means some people are hunter-gatherer societies and they didn't invent the wheel. So what? That's like their representation of their people. And if some people have higher technology, they have higher technology. But as long as there's a balance where we're not like going against each other, where everyone can be sovereign of their land and have a people to belong to that represents their organism. That's like what I believe in. And I'm doing this festival in a few weeks in Peru. It's the first kind of world ethnic festival. There's going to be people from all around the world representing their people, and I'll be there representing my people. And I think this is a very good way to communicate things to people, instead of just acting like a stereotypical hateful person. It just doesn't make any sense to me. It's really immature.
No, absolutely. And I think you'll be a perfect ambassador, to be honest. So I'm glad that you've been asked to do that. So with regards to psychedelics, because this is something that's a little bit unique about you, perhaps, you know, there are a lot of people kind of in the general circles that you and I move in. When it comes to our philosophical ideas, there is often a kind of, well, there's certainly an aversion to anything that's even remotely associated with the New Age, or kind of exotic spiritual beliefs, or certainly psychedelic drugs and things like that. I've always been a lot more open to that. The only experience I've ever had personally was a mushroom trip, which I just did last year. That's the first kind of psychedelic trip that I've ever had, and just liberty caps, you know. I've always been fascinated by that whole world, but I've always believed that with the right methods, you can achieve an altered state of consciousness without the need for drugs. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case, and I don't think that even through the deepest meditation, I don't think you're going to have the same experience that you would have if you took ayahuasca. But what I'd like to ask you is, do you feel like your experiences with psychedelics, do you think that that's contributed to this worldview that you hold now, this kind of this struggle that you've embraced to represent and stand up for your people? Did any of that come through the psychedelic experiences that you had?
Yes, like most of it. And if we go back to really old Indo-European traditions, they talk about using hallucinogenic substances. They talk about it in the Vedas, and they in ancient Greece. So I kind of although I had to go far away and kind of experience it with in exotic lands with not my own people, because they're the only people where they haven't been so Christianized and they still have some of these traditions left. But I never felt like I would see the Westerners and the hippies trying to be Native American. I never was coming from that place. It was always, I had a very kind of Vedic phase in my 20s where I read a lot of the texts, and I think it's a Bhagavad Gita. They talk about, is it Soma? It's a long time ago since I've read these stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And these experiences, I remember this is like 10 years ago, and I had this extremely powerful journey where I was trying to heal my father's lineage, because I come from quite a masculine family, a lot of men, a lot went in the army, and I just sensed there was some brokenness there with the masculine. I'm not trying to attack men, because I know women are going through a crisis and have been completely psyoped with feminism, but I maybe sensed there wasn't empowerment in the fact that we do come from warriors. There was some uprootedness with that. And I went on this very visionary journey where I went through World War I, where I was over the trenches and I could see all these young lads that were trapped in the earth. And it was like the Lord of the Rings scene of the dead army. That's what it kind of looked like. And they were just stuck there. And I had this whole journey that this was a blood sacrifice, that this is, it's like hard to explain in words. And it was, and then I went to World War II, and then I experienced war from many perspectives, from being a soldier wounded, from being a mother saying goodbye to their son, from being a nurse on the front line trying to kind of embody sacred feminine, just nurture, helping these men that had their minds broken. And I feel like I was granted a very deep understanding of the trauma that is in my lineage, and a lot of that trauma from the wars, from industrialization, from the modernity that was built on top, and from the addictions that now kind of riddle these estates and stuff. And
so did it.
I didn't realize.
So it smashed. It's completely smashed this idea that we have in modern popular culture that Europeans have you know, been evil, enslaving the world since time immemorial, you know, the British Empire and yeah, all of this. Whereas the visions that you were shown actually showed the immense amount of suffering that our ancestors have gone through to put us here in this time, yeah, you know, you and I and everyone of this current generation. So, I mean, that's such an important illusion to smash, because the whole idea of mass immigration being some kind of punishment for, you know, evil white behavior throughout the centuries, immediately when you realize that really the English were the first victims of the British Empire, yeah, and then, you know, the Scots and the Irish and the Welsh, and then outward from there to the non-European lands, you know, the Industrial Revolution in England literally displaced regular English folk, took them off the land and put them in these factories where they were suddenly living these very kind of destitute lives. And so is that what you were kind of shown? Is that the feeling that you came away with from these visions?
Yeah, I saw that we are quite a broken people. It's okay. I think we're going to figure it out. But I saw that. I guess I had a bit of the brainwashing, like, caring about all the suffering other people have gone through. And this made me really, really see that the amount of trauma that my own lineage had been through, which had been going through that for a long time, maybe a lot longer than people from non-European parts of the world.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, as I say, I've not had many experiences with psychedelics. In fact, I've only had one. But I have used other methods of, you know, meditative methods, kind of shamanic methods. And the very first you know, journey that I did, the very first shamanic journey I did was after reading a book called by Oak and Ash and Thorn, I think it was. There's a couple of books I had many years ago about Celtic shamanism. And if you read those books, they hammer home constantly the need to recognize your ancestral lineage. And one of the meditative methods that it guides you through is to recognize each you're meant to visualize your ancestors standing at a line, and you're meant to greet each of them in turn, going back through the generations. And this is from a book on Celtic shamanism, which most people reading that book would probably, and probably the authors of that book would probably consider themselves to be very anti-racist, anti-nationalist, anti any sense of ethnic preservation. And yet their own tradition, which they're promoting, is an ancestral one. I mean, shamanism is based on the idea that you, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it is based on the idea that you are drawing from the wisdom of your ancestors that you have the strongest link with. And therefore, by keeping that ancestry intact in a coherent way, so that you are speaking the same language as your ancestors, you are they're therefore able to draw on a greater wisdom than if you had an incoherent lineage. Would you say that that's,
Well, shamanism, I guess, is like, it's a term originally just for Siberian shamans. But I guess it's, people get what you mean when you say shamanism is a way to induce trance states of consciousness for healing and stuff. And it's all based on ancestors and lineages, which is what I started to realize when I was with some of these indigenous Peruvians. I started to see just how much ethnos they had spiritually, and I started to see all the Westerners trying to imitate that. And it's like, why don't we just, it's really nice to like experience a living tradition of like natural medicine, but this is not our own tradition. Although I'm have some suspicions about the origins of ayahuasca, because under the Amazon it's filled with earthworks and it's man-made, it's planted, it's overgrown garden, so who knows where it originally came from. But they've been the guardians of it for some time. But it's a very I know a family, a Shipibo family, and there's, because of all the money that's been brought in with the new age tourism with ayahuasca, it's corrupted a lot of people here, and it's quite sad. But there's this one family that I'm friends with, and they are the real deal. And they're just very racially aware. Like, I've talked to them. They're very proud of their people. They don't want to mix. They want to keep their lineage strong. And they become a shaman because it's passed down through their lineage. Like, not everyone in the tribe is a shaman. It's only like one family that's been there for generations, and it's their craft and they pass it down.
Just
to answer, I don't know if I was rambling.
No, it makes perfect sense. You know, they recognize the importance of kind of a ancestral coherence of, you know, preserving this ancestral line, because that's the most surefire way to preserve the traditions, you know, ensuring that you, you know, because we can kind of look at this from two ways. We can say that if you marry within your ethnic group, then the cultural and linguistic barriers aren't going to be there. You know, if I were to marry a Polish woman, then in learning the tradition of her ancestors, I'm going to have to completely understand her culture. It's going to be a somewhat of a barrier. Even with my best efforts, it's going to be a barrier to understanding the depth of her culture. But then the other way that you can look at it is that there is this folk soul, that we are reincarnated within the ancestors, and that there is this, this knowledge does actually come through the blood. It's not just something that we learn in a material sense, but it's something that does come through the spirit, comes through the blood. It sounds like this family that you're talking about are very much aware of that, that the most direct line to their traditions and preserving them is to maintain their ethnic integrity.
Yeah, it's very obvious. And the last time, I haven't drank for a while, but the last time I drank with them, I was I just remember looking around. It's dark, but I was looking around the room and it's mostly people of European heritage. And then it's his family. And it's a mother who's this old Amazon woman. She's quite beautiful. She has long black hair and that she's dressed traditional. And she's with one of her sons who has this very masculine chieftain energy. And they're singing together. And it was very beautiful, but I started to get a vision of an oak tree and roots coming out of the top of the oak and the bottom of the oak. And it just became very clear to me, like, I have to go home. Like, I've learned everything I can from learning from a people that are still in tune with their natural medicine, with their herbalism, but this is never going to be my culture. And I will see a lot of the Westerners trying to become one of them, and it would make me a bit sad. And I could tell that the Shipibos, I could tell they knew there's something very wrong with where we were coming from, because so many Westerners come and they get so sick in the ceremonies, and they would wonder, like, why are we so sick where we're from? And I think we are spiritually sick, and this has been capitalized upon, you know, this ayahuasca tourism. I don't agree with what's happened with it, and it's been devastating in some ways for the traditions here. In other ways, it's helped them to revive their traditions in a place where missionaries are trying to convert them, so it's like negative and positive. But
that's interesting. So are you almost suggesting that, because this is, you know, when you first investigate these ayahuasca ceremonies, one of the first things that you'll hear about is that, because it's a, from what I hear, it's a putrid substance. It tastes horrible.
Yeah.
And most people who take it, they spend hours, you know, vomiting or whatever. And it's actually initially a horrible experience. But then once you come out the other side of that, then you begin to have these spiritual visions. You go on the journey and things. So yeah. Are you almost suggesting that the physical sickness that Westerners have when they take ayahuasca is almost tied or symbolic of the spiritual sickness that we have because of being a broken people?
Yeah, I think so, because I seem to have learned really fast how to navigate it, which a lot of the Indians noticed in me, which I didn't know was going to happen, but very fast I learned how to navigate it. So you drink it, yes, it's awful and it makes you feel sick, but if you breathe through the sickness, if you sit there and just kind of get through that, a lot of that phase when you feel really sick, so your ego is going to be very strong and it's going to be scared because you're starting to lose control. And that's, so the ego's what it's going to want to hang on. But if you can breathe through that, if you can just maybe purge out something, because you normally will go to a place, a flashback of a trauma that happened to you. And if you can see that, it will make you feel sick, and then you purge it out, and then you can kind of go on this journey, a very visionary journey, and you can learn to navigate it. You can get better at navigating it. But I've drank with just like Indians in the jungle, and it's very different from when I drank with a more new age ceremony with Westerners, because there was a lot of people getting very sick. Whereas if you just drank with a Shipibo family, it's just like extended family. You drink, maybe people get a bit sick, but it's not, it kind of passes. And then you just sing songs together. And it's something that glues them as a people. They do it every so often, and it kind of, it glues them as a collective. And it's, but with the Westerners, I noticed, yeah, with the purging, it was symbolic of our spiritual sickness in a way. I think it's been exploited and capitalized upon with the new age, but I still think that's true, that we need to find ourselves spiritually.
Yeah. So, you know, in light of all of the spiritual explorations and journeys and experiences and that you've had, now, you know, fast forward to 2022, have you fully embraced your ancestral faith? You know, would you consider yourself a heathen or a pagan, or do you still like to kind of, you know, put aside the label and kind of you know, preserve the things that you've learned from elsewhere as well? You know, how do you kind of see yourself these days?
I struggle a bit with labels. I'm confident saying I'm a mother and an artist, but I do have a pagan soul since as young as I can remember. I'm not an expert on my Germanic heritage. I'm trying to relearn it all. But that definitely speaks to me. I've really struggled with Christianity from as young as I can remember. My mother worked, she just volunteered at a local playgroup and they would use the church hall. And back then, no one really went to churches in the cities anymore. But I would go there to help her in the summer holidays and I would sneak into the church bit and look at the stained glass. I do like stained glass windows. I appreciate some of the architecture we made when we were Christianized. But it always felt like a prison to me. And this was when I was really young, before I had like feminist brainwashing playing out in my head. So I understand that a lot of women have been brainwashed just to hate any type of a strong patriarchy, but it felt more than that. I just remember there was something in me that struggled with the church, that Halloween and bonfire night were always my favorite times of years. My parents always told me most of the festivals were pagan. They were very working class. They weren't like part of any pagan group, but they would tell me that these are pagan rites originally. I wasn't brought up in a Christian household. I wasn't christened. And I remember I felt a bit left out at school because I wasn't christened. But my parents always used to say to me, but when you're 16, maybe if you want to be a Christian, then you can get christened then, but we don't want to christen you because it's not for us.
Like, it's so, not. It sounds like you had wonderful parents. Like they,
yes, I did.
you speak like, yeah, anyone who follows Emma's Telegram channel or her YouTube and that, she does speak very fondly about her parents, and obviously with good reason. I mean, my parents are both, I'd say they're atheists, at best agnostics, and they did have me christened, but that was purely because a cousin of mine is about the same age and his parents, my uncle and auntie, are quite Christian, so they plan to have him christened, so my parents just decided to get me done at the same time.
Well, it's a tradition.
Yeah, it's just a tradition thing, yeah. But yeah, honestly, you're not missing out on anything having not been christened. But yeah, there's so much to learn about our ancestral faith. And, you know, I do kind of go back and forth on the idea of orthodoxy and whether it's okay to learn from foreign traditions or not. I mean, I think ultimately I would say that it is, because there are certain perennial truths, certain truths which are universal and objective. But I've always said that every ethnic group should view those eternal truths through their own cultural lens.
Yeah.
So for us, that's through the runes, and it's through the Eddas, and through the folklore of our lands, the British folk tales, and all of these things which do point to these eternal spiritual truths. And you know, we have in our folk tales, we obviously have fairy tales about, you know, the fairy world and fairy rings and things, and that obviously ties into some of the experiences that people have when they take ayahuasca and the otherworldly entities that they see during those experiences. So those things I do believe are universal. I don't think that, I mean, maybe I could ask you this actually, you know, during some of the experiences, the psychedelic experiences you've had, have you encountered other entities that you believe to be more than just some kind of figment of your imagination? And would you identify them as things like fairies or elves or dwarves, which we have in our Northern European folklore?
Yeah. So I feel like I can distinguish between hallucinations because of the chemical imbalance going on in the head. But then there's also places you go to, realms you go to, and entities you meet that feel very real. And this is why I got into the whole visionary art scene, because after I had that experience in 2012, I would see paintings that depicted exactly where I went. These realms that kind of look like these grand cathedrals. They're not really Christian, but kind of this architecture. And you would go through them and... yeah, you would meet entities, I remember one time I had an experience where I was taken up really high to the cosmos, to Orion's belt, it felt like, and I was getting heart surgery by these very tall beings that were kind of glowing purple with big eyes. It's hard to explain. They were telepathically telling me everything's okay, and they rewired my heart. I could see them do it, and then they put it back in me, and I feel I was so blocked and everything. And after that experience, I've been able to have relationships. I've been able to develop friendships, because before that, I just closed myself off to the world because I had a lot of pain. And I thought, okay, that's an interesting experience. And then I saw a painting of exactly the same thing, of someone having heart surgery by exactly the same beings. So that's interesting. I think.
I feel like I've heard others talk about that, pretty much that exact same experience before. So
yeah. So I think we don't understand these things. It's a shame that the psychedelic movement is very left-wing. A lot of it's heavily funded by Soros. It's being used kind of a way to, because it puts people in a very vulnerable mentality. And I see this with the New Age, with fake shamans that kind of manipulate people to give them all their money, because they keep telling them they're healing them, but they need to keep going back to them. So because it makes people very vulnerable. So they're trying to do this on a social scale. I kind of see the modern MK Ultra, but there's still something in it. There's still something to it. And I think one day we will understand this more. I guess it was ayahuasca that kind of was my initial experience, although I did Liberty Caps back in England and in Scotland. But then since I've been in the Andes over the years, it's been mostly San Pedro cactus. And San Pedro cactus is associated with Viracocha, who had a red beard. He was a pale man who came on a ship. And this is the association, like he's associated to this plant that in kind of their creation myth a long time ago, men in ships came and they had this ceremony connected to San Pedro. I feel sometimes when I see some aspects of the New Age, which is mostly people of European heritage, maybe they go to India or maybe they come here, but there's traces in these parts of the world of very ancient Indo-European travelers and people that went there a long time ago. So I sometimes think maybe we are trying to rediscover something and then everything gets subverted.
Yeah. Why is it? Do you think, you know, because the likes of, you know, you mentioned that Soros, George Soros funds a lot of this kind of psychedelic global popularity and movement. And then you have the likes of Russell Brand. He's, I've heard, has been quite, outspokenly, you know, positive about ayahuasca and things. And all kinds of celebrities are talking about ayahuasca trips. It's really become popular over the last 10 years. And it doesn't feel like an organic movement in any way. Obviously you kind of became, you know, you were enveloped in that before it became this kind of big almost consumer product. Why do you think someone like George Soros would want to usher particularly Western people towards this kind of transcendental shamanic psychedelic world? What do you think is in it for them? What are they trying to do to us?
I think that because it's boundary dissolving, I think they're just trying to usher in a kind of a global utopian spiritual religion. And they're using particularly ayahuasca to do that, because ayahuasca actually in its traditional context is connected to sorcery. So most of the tribes in the Amazon, they have used ayahuasca for centuries to kill rivals, to kill rival tribes. In the, if you want to call it the astral, I don't know, but if they kill their rival in the ayahuasca realms, they will get a sickness in real life. This is what they say. Mm-hmm. And being around in Peru, because I kind of live in this spiritual tourist route, I don't get involved with it too much, but I'm around it. There's just so much darkness to it and kind of black magic. And I didn't necessarily believe in black magic and sorcery before I came here, but it's definitely very real to the people here. And it's interesting because they've picked ayahuasca, but they haven't picked San Pedro cactus, whereas San Pedro cactus, I feel for me in the long run, actually helped me more with my creativity. And it's a very light experience, whereas ayahuasca, it can get quite dark. And if you're not in a good space, I've seen it kind of ruin people's minds. And I just believe it is a substance. Is it the Brave New World they talk about, a soma substance to help control humanity? And I definitely see that ayahuasca has the potential to be used in that.
Yeah, Huxley definitely talked about constant medication. I can't remember what terms he used for the medication, but he talked about people basically constantly being on drugs of some sort.
Yeah, which is a lot of the spiritual tourists here, they get addicted to ayahuasca. And then they're like, well, it's medicine, I'm not addicted. And I'm like, no, it's still a drug and you're addicted to it because you're trying to escape with it. So it's kind of sad, because for me it was positive, but then I'm at a point where I'm wondering, should everyone even experience this? Is it just for certain like lineages in the community that oversee healing? Because in the tribes, not all of them drink. Sometimes they'll get together and they'll all drink, but mostly it's the ayahuascaro who will drink. If someone's sick, they will drink, and then they'll go to the sick person and they'll figure out what plants they need to gather from the jungle to make the person better. So this whole ayahuasca tourism setup of these new age ceremonies isn't even rooted in their traditions. It's just kind of this modern thing that I've seen it confuse a lot of people. Because when I had the positive experience from it, I really got excited about it. Like, I spoke out at conventions. I really thought it could heal the world. I was young. I was in my 20s. And in the years following, I've kind of distanced myself from that. I still believe that we do need some rites and we need initiation ceremonies. We need certain marking points in our journey as humans, initiations into adulthood, where they might be accompanied with psychoactive plants or just a method to alter the state of consciousness that can humble our egos to help us grow and mature. But this whole new age ayahuasca tourism I'm very suspicious. And not only did George Soros, he's heavily funded the MAPS psychedelic science, whatever they are, who are now doing anti-racist therapy. He also funded a lot of the decriminalization of cannabis in America. And I'm someone that appreciates cannabis. It's been very beneficial to me, but you have to be very disciplined with it. It can also be used to numb yourself from reality. And I also think it should be connected to medicine, to rites, to spiritual rites. It shouldn't just be a way to numb the masses. But through the legalization of cannabis, there's been these really high strains, GMO cannabis. There's been new ways to take weed like dabs that just really rot the minds of young people. So it's not that these things are bad. These things are quite sacred. Cannabis was spread by Indo-Europeans in the ancient world, but they are definitely being weaponized against us.
It seems to me like the likes of Soros and others who are involved with promoting this whole psychedelic movement that we've seen over the last decade or so, it seems to me like what they've identified is that Western people, European people, have suddenly realized, we've realized that we lost our own native spirituality. Some of us recognize that Christianity was dealt a huge blow to it a long, long time ago. Some maybe don't feel that way, but they just feel like we are missing something that the rest of the world has. But the likes of Soros, they recognize that if we were to discover our own native spirituality, and we have our own methods and our own native plant medicines as well that we can use. They realize that if we discover that, then with that comes an undeniable appreciation of our ethnic identity. Whereas if they can push us to the other side of the world, to this non-native, as in not native to us, spirituality, you know, this kind of spiritual tradition, which is global and detached from our own heritage, then it can kind of sate us. It can sate that hunger that we have for something real and indigenous, but without all of the kind of dangerous, in inverted commas, religious baggage that comes with that, that might be a threat to the globalists if we were to find our native traditions. Do you think that that's probably, you know,
I think that's how it is? They're just trying to make sure we do not have an awakening of any kind, because if the European, if our people remembered who are the descendants of some of the fiercest warriors to ever have lived, if we were awakened in our spiritual rights, in our native organic spirituality, we could easily bring them to their feet, but they don't want that to happen. So we're very psyoped, we're abused, even how we come into this world, born in hospitals, like the moment we're born, we're kind of made to be disconnected. You know, we're not supposed to be taken away from the mothers as soon as you're born. You're not supposed to have the umbilical cord cut. I'm not having a go at anyone. I had to have a hospital birth. It's just that from we are kind of ripped apart from nature as soon as we come into this world, and they don't want us to connect to that. And even 10 years ago, when I was first in the Amazon, the people down there was saying, oh yeah, there's like the CIA are starting to come. And this is like just before it got really popular. So I know there's some people who tend to be Christian that say it was all like it's all subversion to begin with. But I believe that some of these European hippies were just trying to return to nature. And I feel then it got subverted.
Yeah, I fully agree. And it actually, what it kind of confirms for us is, you know, if they're so worried about us returning to our native spirituality that they're going to push us towards a non-native one, it actually gives us some indication of what they're really fearful of, and the fact that probably more so than political engagement, because they're not worried about us being politically engaged. Yes, they'll stop us from voting for certain, they'll stop certain political parties from arising, but they're more than happy for us to vote. They're more than happy for us to have a political opinion on Twitter. Seemingly what they're not happy about is for us to practice our native spirituality. So therein lies the threat to them.
Yeah. But it's awakening. And with some of, I just say hippie, I don't necessarily know if that's the right word, just people of European heritage interested in holistic medicine, health, organic food, like returning to balance with nature. Since COVID, a lot of them are aware of so many things, even the anti-white agenda. They're aware of it now because they've been anti-facts for decades. And suddenly, like me and all my friends, we were all called far-right white supremacist Nazis for simply believing in natural medicine. So they've really pushed a whole lot of people into a corner that's woke a lot of people up. And I think some of these people, that there needs to be kind of a bridge. And I see kind of something very positive happening, because it's very hard to demonize people like me and some of my friends that are clearly not hateful, but yet we're going to defend our people and our homelands, and we're going to use the language that they recognize that they have used against us for a long time, and we're going to use it back at them. And what can they say? They try and call me a racist, and I'm like, my son's godparents are indigenous Americans. I speak Quechua to them. I'm very accepted. I've been to the Navajo Nation. I was accepted. Like, it's very hard for them to like demonize me and put me into a box. And there's a lot of people like me now since COVID.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I've seen the same thing. I've definitely seen those two previously kind of separated camps of people, the kind of the more sort of new age conspiracy theorist, natural medicine type and anti-vax type. And actually, it's on a kind of selfish note, it's been a really positive couple of years for me, because I came to the kind of folkish nationalist mindset from the conspiratorial one. You know, as I say, I was introduced to the kind of the dissident worldview via the philosophical ideas of people like Graham Hancock, who is completely removed from nationalism, and even David Icke, you know, a lot of those ideas. And then for me, that merged with this idea of a sense of ethnic identity and the will to preserve that. So those two previously separate camps have kind of converged over the last couple of years, because yeah, we've been pushed together kind of against our will. And whereas, you know, 5-10 years ago, I was regularly getting into trouble with nationalists for being too conspiratorial minded or too hippie, and getting in trouble with the kind of the hippie conspiracy type crowd for being too, for putting too much importance on ethnic identity and the preservation thereof. You know, I mean, I literally got, I mean, the number of arguments I've had with some quite big names who I won't name, but some people who in the nationalist scene who denounced me as a conspiracy theorist. And they've gone pretty quiet now, because of the conspiracy theories that I went on about for many years of, you know, and this is the same for many of us, yourself probably as well.
Well, I don't see how you can see the clear replacement of Europeans, the conspiracy that's going on there, and then pretend that all the other conspiracies, oh, they're just silly far out conspiracies. Because I saw that a lot with the distant right, with the vaccines, just kind of taking the piss out of people that were questioning that. And I think some of these, you know, some of these conspiracy theorists that might be a bit out there and mad, but that they still have a intuition about things. You know, back in the day, they say that shamans or the healer, the wizards, whatever you want to call them, they would have been considered by today's standards as mentally ill. But it's because they were in tune with a lot of stuff, and they would have lived apart from the village, and they would have probably been a bit of a madman, but they would have sensed stuff. And
That's a really good way of putting it, actually. It's I think what we're seeing over the last couple of years is the merging of the left brain and the right brain. You know, the kind of right brain, which is kind of senses things and is more instinctual, and then the left brain, which is more kind of empirical and calculating and stuff. And those two sides of the brain almost represent the kind of the conspiratorial side, you know, conspiratorial, I say the conspiracy theorist, so to speak, and the kind of, you know, nationalist side of things. And those two are kind of coming together. So yeah, I agree that there's something positive coming out of this. And this leads on nicely to the kind of last thing I wanted to ask you about, really, is how do you see things unfolding from here? You know, obviously we've got this, the push for Agenda 2030 and the kind of inventorying of mankind through, you know, social credit system and vaccine passports and, you know, these kind of new mRNA jabs and things like that. That's full speed now. How do you see the coming few years? What do you think are going to be the most important things that we can do to position ourselves against that? What do you intend to do to prepare for the kind of years ahead?
So I feel like there's a lot of expats around me that are very scared and want to go to the jungle. And I had this mentality for a while, and I just want to come home now, and I want to be strong in my soul and have faith that we will resist. At the same time, I want to focus on community building, and I have some contacts that have land, and I want to become as self-sufficient as possible to start building something parallel to leave to my son. But at the same time, it's hard to get away from the system. It's in the Amazon, it's everywhere on earth nearly. So at the same time as preparing for collapse and all this, I want to just be strong in who I am and resist. And I kind of have visions, because I watched a lot of the protests with COVID and stuff, and then some of the protests maybe against the migrant situation in England, which gets so heavily demonized. It's very easy to demonize the working class, these kind of middle class journalists. They're pretty atrocious how they can just ridicule and look down on them, where these are people that are the most affected by demographic replacement. Their daughters get raped and they're very angry. And I kind of have some visions of some very hyper indigenous, beautiful resistance. I don't know, painting my face blue, wearing tartans, standing in a stone circle, making it clear this is my native homeland. I am a native people. This is my indigenous homeland. Using this language, which is so often used against us, and using that against the system and resisting. So I have some ideas that maybe we have to come together and collectivize and get together and do gatherings and stuff. At the same time, community building, becoming self-sufficient, learning human skills again, like growing food. Everyone used to do this. It's not normal to just not know how to grow food. And we've been so uprooted, we just go to the supermarket. But we need to know these skills again. We need to know the seasons and how to get through and come out of our comfort. And yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I think everyone of our mindset has come to these same conclusions. And I don't think it's just because we're sharing ideas and catching on to them. I think we all instinctively know that becoming more self-sufficient and more detached from their system is the only way that we're going to preserve anything for our future descendants. And, you know, you're a mother, I'm a father. That's what our life is about now, is setting up some kind of new society for our children. I think the real question that I have is, how much of the current system do we have to relinquish? You know, because I think everyone's got a slightly different idea about how much of the old system we can hold on to. You know, some people think that we can still have the internet in our new system. Some people think, no, we can't have the internet. You know, some people think we can still use smartphones. Some people don't. Some people think that we can still use the hospitals, the NHS. Some people don't. You know, so I think everyone has a slightly different perception of how much of the current system we can still make use of. I think, you know, I put out a poll recently on Telegram about should we, the unvaccinated, have a right to know who is vaccinated before, you know, possibly having children with them? Personally, I want to ensure that my children, because my children have never had a single injection, not just the COVID one.
Nor has my wife. Mine.
Yeah, it gets great.
And it's really healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I mean, mine couldn't be healthier. And I'm sure the same goes for yours. And, you know, my wife and I have been so-called anti-vax for over 10 years, because our eldest child is 9 now, and she's not had a single needle put inside of her. So, but I want to ensure that my children are always able to avoid partnering with someone who has had the vaccine. And, you know, I know that some people think that sounds uncompassionate of me to discriminate against someone who's been vaccinated, because a lot of those people didn't know what they were letting themselves in for. A lot of them felt like they had no choice and they were coerced. But nevertheless, my duty is to protect my bloodline. It's as simple as that. So my point of view now is kind of, well, can we even accept blood transfusions? And if we can't accept blood transfusions, then can we have an operation performed on us in a regular hospital? Yeah, I know. I mean, these are kind of ideas that have come to me quite recently, and partly because of things that people have said in the comments to my Telegram channel. But these are the kind of things that we do need to consider. So, you know, but whereas before I kind of thought, well, yeah, if you can use natural medicines, then do it. But if you do need to have an operation for whatever reason, then yeah, go to the hospital if they let you in without a vaccine passport.
Yeah.
But now I'm thinking, well, what if you do that and then they give you a blood transfusion from someone who's had the mRNA vaccine? You know, these are kind of I think these are going to be the big, big important questions for people like us over the coming years, is how much of the current system can we still take of?
Well, hopefully there will be some doctors. Hopefully there will be a split with some people with these skills that will come and join us if we start to build something. And we can have, because I live in a place where there's not the best modern medicine. I had quite a traumatic labor. I tried to have a natural birth, 72 hours, had to get rushed to hospital. I didn't have any pain relief. It was quite traumatic, and it did made me appreciate some modern medicine, even though I will only use it if necessary. But I think all we can do is build and inspire a new path for our people, and hopefully people will join, doctors will join. We can build our own hospitals that are not there to make profit on sickness, that actually help people, and just have faith in that. Like, I had a few years of being quite overwhelmed by everything, but I've just got to a point now where it's actually quite an exciting time to be alive. We have an opportunity to be part of something that maybe spoke about in future folklore. Like, this is a big epoch we're in. The darkness is very overwhelming. And if you can see that, if you can see the sorcery, because I feel like people are under a spell. I feel at the highest levels, it's sorcery that's happening. I know maybe that sounds irrational to some people, but I don't know any other way to describe what has happened to our people. We were from a strong people, and we've allowed ourselves to become very brainwashed, and it looks like a lot of people are literally under a spell.
I couldn't agree more, and I don't think there's anything outrageous about that. I mean, when I watched a video the other day of some, he was an English guy, but I think he was talking in the Irish Parliament, and he was talking about replacement migration and the fact that Ireland and Europe would have no choice but to embrace the hordes of African migrants who were going to come in, that this was an inevitability, and actually it was something that we should be welcoming and preparing for, and this, that, and the other. And I was just looking at him on this video, and I was thinking, there is no way that that man is not under a spell. There is no way that a healthy person can ever talk about the destruction of their own people in a manner like that without having some kind of deep sorcery or spell or sickness cast upon them. I don't quite know how to. I mean, this is one of the reasons that, and I get criticized for this, but this is one of the reasons that I have this interest in Gnosticism, particularly as interpreted and presented by John Lamb Lash, because of his idea of the archons, this kind of this otherworldly consciousness, which is actually the pushing this sorcery, pushing these spells upon people. Because to me, it explains so much. It feels like there must be some kind of demonic entity that is causing this within people.
And when I had that journey over the trenches, and then I saw that the First and Second World War were basically blood sacrifices, it felt very unearthly. The force behind that, the force that needed to spill the blood on the land, it didn't feel human.
No.
So I think there is something parasitical, maybe not from this realm, that is feasting upon it, feasting upon everything that's beautiful, all the light. It's like Mordor, like we're occupied by Mordor.
Yeah, absolutely. And in Old English, our word for giants, which are in the Nordic languages is called the Jotnar. We call them the Ettin, which etymologically is related to the word eat. So they are the eaters, what we call the giants. So, you know, this is an idea that I've kind of, played around with in my mind for a long time. Why did our ancestors called the adversaries of our gods the Ettin, the eaters? Why were they known as the eaters? What is it about them? And I can't help thinking that it does tie into this idea of human sacrifice, and this idea that they do draw upon the energy of human suffering in the way that you saw in your vision. So, you know, I really don't think that you can, preclude or remove the spiritual or esoteric aspect of the struggle that we're going through today, which is why this pagan, shamanic, otherworldly interest that people like you and I and lots of the listeners have, I think, is so important to what we're doing.
Yeah. And to reclaim it from all these like gay pagan things I see online that are trying to make out our ancestors were like into trans stuff, when yeah, I feel like we would have to make a real stand for our native indigenous spirituality. And
yeah, 100%. I mean, they are undoubtedly that those so-called self-proclaimed pagans who are accepting all of the devices of this demonic entity of the, you know, the Etian or the frost giants or whatever we want to, the archons, whatever we want to call them, they are literally working against the gods whilst claiming to represent them. So yeah, absolutely, we need to take it back from them.
Yeah.
So you're hopefully, I gather, returning to England or Britain quite soon, I guess next spring. Is that your plan?
Yeah, England in spring. I hope they let me out this time. They should do. Because to them, my son is Peruvian. He's born in Peru. And they have really strict laws because there's a lot of human trafficking. So it's actually a good law, but he has to leave on his Peruvian. And I just thought he could leave on his British. And then it's a third world, so there was this 9-month waiting list to get a new passport. Right. But I felt like, in a way, I was rushing it, because this is very sacred land here. The mountains here are just riddled in megaliths. There's these elongated skulls that are found all over here, and they're human. They're not ancient aliens. But recently, the Ministry of Archaeology, along with the American, got them tested, their genetics, and they basically came back with a marker from the Black Sea, and they were pale skinned and they had red hair and green eyes, and they were here only a few hundred years ago. So I feel like there is something that brought me here. I feel when I go to these megalithic remains that are so old, they're these perfectly carved blocks that have been scattered like some catastrophe happened across the landscape, and they have really high erosion levels at the top, like they've melted in some intense heat. I feel like I came here to remember something. Maybe my ancestors did come here a long time ago. There's something here I needed to remember, and I'm appreciating my final time here. I'm going to as many megaliths as possible, and yeah, just getting strong and getting ready to return. Because a lot of people are like, oh, don't come back here, it's shit. And I'm like, I know it's occupied and everything, but it's, maybe I'll just be super positive because I'm so homesick. I feel I'm going to cry when I see an oak tree. And
do you know what? Like, the grass is always greener on the other side. And I really think that a lot of the people that say, oh, you know, England is done for, Britain's done for, Europe's done for. I don't believe that at all. Yes, no. We've got some serious problems and, you know, things are tough here in many ways, but some things we really do have, in some ways we have a lot going for us. Yeah. I mean, I think just the character of the people, first and foremost, is, you know, yes, a lot of people bought into the COVID lie, but a lot of people either did that reluctantly and half-heartedly or didn't buy into it at all. And I think in Britain, there's been as much resistance as there has in any other country in the world, if not more, dare I say. So, yeah, we've got a lot going for us here. And, you know, I'd love to visit South America, various places in South America. And I kind of envy you the fact that you've been able to immerse yourself in that for so long. And maybe I'll get to do it in another life or something. But having recently moved to rural North Wales, what I'm finding, like when I go for walks around here, I get such a sense of how ancient this place is. And that's not to say that England isn't ancient as well, but just the very language, you know, the Welsh language just feels incredibly ancient. And you go for a walk through a forest and there's like a 6-foot high stone wall covered in moss, which clearly hasn't served a purpose in centuries probably. And you just left wondering, how long has that really been there, you know? So, that sense of antiquity, obviously, it exists where you are now in Peru, but it also exists in Europe, for sure.
And the point I want to make, you made a good point, is that with COVID, there was hardly any resistance here, and still people are in masks. And I came to realize that they seem very susceptible to brainwashing here. And not only were they very, they really like went along with it and there was no pushback. They were sterilized in the 90s via jabs, I think, in Peru, the more indigenous societies when they had this Japanese president. But they have seemed to have forgotten that. And it started to concern me. And I started to realize, and even when I go to these old sites, that when I talk to the local people, they don't claim to know who built them. They say they were ancient to their ancestors. So the magic that was once here, it's not really, I mean, there is something in the air, but the people who built them, they're not here anymore. And there's no resistance. And the military came in with COVID. They were on the streets. If they caught you outside, they put you in a truck and took you to the plaza and made you do sit-ups and laps, which was really a bit intense. It made me very aware I'm in the third world and that things can get really bad here really fast. And that actually within my people, there is hope of a resistance, even if a lot of people are brainwashed. And there's also still like common law. There's some basic things that there's not that in the third world. Mm. And I just don't feel comfortable here. And I see I've got some very close British friends here and it's sad. I can see they're really scared. And I tell them I'm going home and they're like, oh, I'm just going to stay here. Like they're scared and it's sad, but it's like, I don't know what you think there is here. You know, they were so submissive to COVID. There's no resistance. The military were everywhere. That you've got more chance with your own people than hiding away with another people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wish you the best of luck in getting back over here with your son. And I hope our paths can cross someday and, you know, we can, get something going. I know you have some ideas about putting some kind of gathering together sometime. Yeah. So, yeah, I've already said to Emma that if I can help with that, then I will. I'd certainly love to attend it if we manage to pull it off. So, it's been really enjoyable talking to you and learning your story and that. So thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me, Dan. It was really nice.
So as always, we'll finish with the answer to last episode's riddle from the Exeter Riddle Book, which I thought was quite an obvious one. And yes, it is what I guessed it was, which is plow. I'm sure many of you got that. Most of you got that as well. That one seemed to be quite self-explanatory, really. We have lines like, I burrow deep into the earth, guided by the grey foe of the forest and by my lord. Born on a wagon, I have many scars. So I guess the scars would be from tilling the ground. There's green on one flank wherever I go. That points to the fact that, you know, as you're progressing with ploughing a field, you have the unploughed field on one side of you and the ploughed field on the other side of you. So, the riddle for this episode, number 22, is as follows. 60 men in company came, riding down to the estuary. 11 of those mounted men had horses of peace, and 4 had pale grey horses. The warriors could not cross the water, as they wished, for the channel was too deep. The shelf too abrupt, the current too strong, the choppy waves thronging. Then the men and their horses climbed onto a wagon, a burden under the crossbar, and then a single horse hauled those proud spear warriors with their steeds, dragged the wagon right across the estuary. Although no ox, nor cart horse, nor muscular men dragged it with him, and he did not swim, nor wade on the bottom because of his guest's weight, nor muddy the water, nor ride on the wind, nor double back. Rather, he carried the warriors and their horses across the creek, from the steep bank, the staith, so that they stepped up bravely on the opposite side, men and their mounts unscathed by water. Yeah, I don't know what the significance of the numbers, the 11 mounted men and 4 had pale grey horses. I don't know what the significance of the numbers is there, but I always particularly enjoy riddles which kind of incorporate mathematics or even kind of sacred mathematics within. So yeah, I'll be interested to kind of dig into the answer to that one. But I never check the answer to these riddles until the next episode when I read it out to you. And if I feel that it's worth kind of exploring the meaning of it, then I do so. But sometimes it's quite obvious. This one, I mean, my first thought is a boat or a raft, but then it does say, nor ride on the wind. So yeah, I don't know, maybe unless it's by power of oar stroke. But anyway, I hope you do enjoy the riddle section of this. I guess those of you that don't will have turned off by now, and those of you that do are still listening. And as always, I thank you very much for listening to and supporting the Fergan podcast. T-shirts and hoodies and long sleeves available on fergan.com. And yeah, particularly to my patrons on Subscribestar, Substack, and Patreon. I'm very grateful to you. And to anyone that simply shares the podcast, and just those of you who get something from it, who enjoy the guests that I have, the ideas that I share. Yeah, this is for you. So thank you all, and I'll speak to you all in the next episode.